From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome back to Defrag. And so we're going to start Defrag this week with your correction.
Oh, about the Ready Boost drives?
Yeah, Ready Boost. It's just, you were thinking FAT32.
Yeah, so oddly enough, when I was setting up my new machines for my HTPC, grabbed some thumb drives and broke them out of the box, stuffed it in, didn't even bother formatting them, and it, you know, gave with a max of 4 gig. It's like, okay, I don't really have any more than 4 gig in this machine anyways for RAM. I didn't bother looking at it any deeper than that.
All right, so the long and short is if you are a 64-bit system, mm-hmm. NTFS, your
Ready
Boost
drive. Format the flash drive is NTFS, and then you can utilize more than 4 gig as your Ready Boost cache.
So will it use, I mean, do you benefit from using like a 16-gig Ready Boost drive?
Sure.
Of course. Okay.
I mean, what the general rule is, you know, same amount as what you have as RAM.
Yeah, and so. This woodpecker is really out of the corner of my eye grabbing that. So.
Thank you, Bing.
Today's show brought to you by Bing. Okay, so there's a correction on there. Let's get to some of the comments from the show last week. From Tricky Dicky, do you know of any good guides for setting up a home group between Windows 7 host and a VMware guest running Windows 7?
So I don't have too much experience, at least with current VMware guests, but the real thing to remember is that whatever guest technology, whatever VM technology that you're using, the emulated NIC has to support IPv6.
Okay.
Because Homegroup relies on IPv6. But other than that, things should just work. It should just, you know, to the network, there should be no difference.
Okay.
You know, as long as you're, you know, bridging your host NIC to the rest of the network into your VMs, they should all see each other. They should all be getting DHCP from, you know, your router or whatever. And you should be able to use it as a home group, no problem.
Excellent. And Tricky Dicky also asked, Hyper-V is, what's he say? By the way, Virtual PC doesn't like 64-bit guests. Question?
That's true. It doesn't. Use okay. Hyper-V.
Yeah, there you go. All right. From Windev, oh boy, here's the... So he writes, you still have Windows M confused with Windows D. Windows D toggles desktop display regardless of whether the Windows minimize support or not. Windows M just does minimize on and on. You can read the thing from last week. Let's talk a little bit about this. And we were playing with this before the show.
Yeah, and it's really messed up. I mean, first off, I wanted to point out, you know, we have... a KB kind of article on Microsoft.com talking about the Windows shortcuts.
Yeah.
Talks about all of the Win logo key type shortcuts. And, you know, what we're talking about here are Win key D and Win key M.
Yeah.
Something that we noticed, if we hit Win key D, we get to the desktop.
Perfect.
We hit it again, we bring back to whatever it is that we were looking at, right? You hit Win key M, it minimizes everything.
Yeah.
You hit Win key M again, nothing happens.
Yeah.
The alternate shortcut to bring everything back is Windows key Shift M. Guess what?
Nothing happened.
Nothing happens. You're kind
but
of
bring
in this...
it back and show that that actually does work if you didn't accidentally hit it a second time.
Sure. So we hit Win key M to minimize, Win key Shift M to unminimize.
So if you only hit Windows M once,
you're okay.
And then you hit Windows Shift M, it's going to come back. But if you have accidentally hit it twice for whatever reason,
you're completely screwed.
So I thought, when I was thinking about this, I thought Windows M was just going to minimize the front window, the window that had focus.
No, it does it all.
Okay. So, and the thing that I always use, because I don't use Windows M, I use Alt space N, which will minimize a window.
Mm-hmm.
And so that just minimizes one window. And so that was what I was thinking it was. And this is very... unexpected behavior.
To me, it's just confusing.
Yeah.
More than anything else.
I just keep using the Windows D for showing the desktop, and I'm going to keep using my Alt Space N. The only thing it doesn't work on is emails because
right.
It uses a different menu there. But
yeah, for me, I rarely ever use those particular keyboard shortcuts because I have multiple monitors all the time, and I don't ever minimize anything. I just bring up new windows on top of each other. I don't care about looking at my desktop, really. It's not all that interesting for me.
Different strokes for different folks. So, you know, you can do whatever you need to get your job done.
Exactly.
Okay. So there you have it. From Tony, please provide an MP3 version of this show. That's in the process of being fixed. So we usually have an MP3 that you can download. So if you just want to hear the sweet audio of our voices, then you can do that. But
imagine whoever you like when we're talking.
Yeah. Nice. All right, and then we got a question from Brian Vandiver. It says, I enjoy watching your show, which is why it's the first question that we were asking here. You know how to get through. It has a question about virtual disk images, VHD. He uses many virtual machines for both work and personal use. Is there any benefit to defragging the VHD?
Sure. When you take a step back and you visualize what it is on disk, right? The VHD is nothing but a container for your OS.
It's often a very big one.
Often a very big one, just like a partition is. But a VHD will sit on a partition, but it's still just a file.
Yeah.
So, what you can do, and is certainly not discouraged or anything, is to defragment the VHD itself outside of the VM. So, you've shut down your VM. Mm-hmm. In your host environment, you can defrag the VHD so that it at least is one contiguous file on disk.
But inside the VHD...
Inside the VHD, when you're booted in, you're abstracted out from, whatever the location on the disk is.
Yeah.
So it's not as beneficial. In fact, I'm trying to figure out if there is any benefit whatsoever. You're going to get the biggest benefit by just defragging the entire file.
Yeah.
And be done with it that way.
Okay, excellent. All right, next question. Is there an easy way to print to my home printer when I'm on the road or at work?
Oh, absolutely. I love this question. I don't know if anyone remembers. It was one of our, I think our third show, maybe fourth show.
It was way back in the day. We'll link to it in the show notes. I'll find it.
I talked about setting up a VPN to your home network, using PPTP, point-to-point tunneling protocol. This is the perfect example for that. Remote desktop can work. Is by no means never going to work. You just have to remember not to bring, whatever currently connected printer that you have to your remote desktop session. Using PPTP to VPN back into your home network is, to me, even simpler. You'll have access to all of your other resources as you would with a remote desktop, but... Yeah. It takes a little bit less bandwidth because you're not sending back screen images all the time. You'll just print to it just like you would anything else. And you get to use, the apps on your machine as opposed to the apps if you remote desktoped into a machine on your home network. Or maybe you don't leave machines running all the time in your home network,
Yeah.
Or whatever machine you're VPNing into doesn't have the application that you use to print.
Mm-hmm.
So... You can use the VPN and get everything you need done.
Excellent. We'll link to that previous show. Okay, next question. I need to install VirtualPC on Windows 7 Home Premium 64-bit. As far as I know, VirtualPC is available just for Pro Ultimate Edition. One, can I install VirtualPC on Home Premium Edition? And two, what other options do I have?
You have.
Answer one is no.
Yeah, unfortunately, for numerous reasons, most of which I don't want to get into, you can't install VirtualPC specifically on Home Premium.
Yeah, and answer two, what can I do? In-place upgrade to Pro.
Sure.
So you can always do that. Next question. I've got a question about bringing the command window to the front so a screenshot can be taken and tracked and then emailed to the person. So it's a longer question, but the basic part of it is they're doing some kind of thing on their computer. They want to bring that window to the front, take a screenshot, email it to themselves. And you wanted to dive back into why.
Yeah, so when we were reading this question, the background behind it was they were running some sort of automation in that command window, and they wanted to get, the results of it, the success or failure or whatever, from that automation, and they wanted to email a screenshot of that window to them. And I kind of looked at it going, wow, would I really ever want to look at an image for that? Because for numerous reasons, like if you're getting tons of these mails, perhaps from multiple different machines,
yeah,
how are you necessarily going to search the logs? You know, mm-hmm. like all you're going to get is a screenshot, maybe the important information. You're not actually going to be able to search for it easily.
Yeah.
So I figured, you know, going back, diving into the problem, the right thing to do is actually just to email the results of what are the whatever the automation is. Mm-hmm. So log those results that's coming in the command window to a file by redirection or by, you know, any other means of creating log files. And then email those log files to yourself using MAPI APIs
okay.
or, you know, any other third-party program in order to, say, watch a folder, and then when a certain number of files come, it send off an email as those ones attachment. There's a lot of different ways of doing it, but I really would never recommend taking a screenshot and emailing a screenshot of results
yeah.
that was just text to begin with.
Yeah. All right, good one. So the next question, since XP mode is technically a Windows 7 component, will it be kept in the same support life cycle as XP? And the answer is no.
Well, the XP mode is being kept in the same life cycle support as XP, but the fact that XP support goes off in 2014.
That's true.
Same with XP mode. XP mode does not have the same life cycle as Windows 7, which it was designed for.
And it's all described right here in this fact, so
right.
you can find out that XP mode, or XP support ends in 2014, I believe.
Yeah, 2014.
So there you have it. Yeah, it's it ends with XP. All right, next question. Is it possible in Windows 7 to exclude access to a user's temp internet files that are stored under the user profile directory? So a local administrator or domain admin would not be able to view files in that directory. I'm not sure if it's possible because of location or what else. The concern is that the temp files there may contain sensitive information from when a user's access when a user accessed sites such as banking and medical, etc. We know what we're talking about here. Yeah, banking and medical. But the thing I would suggest to use is in private,
yeah.
which will give you a little bit of that benefit.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely like what it was designed for, you know.
Yeah.
You want to make sure that none of the stuff that you're looking at is persisted on disk. It also in private mode is, you know, make sure that third-party extensions aren't being run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, you know, to have a better container around what you're doing. And that's truly what it's designed for. As you may know, I've probably said this multiple times, is that an admin is essentially God on the machine. So
yeah.
there's potentially ways to, you know, get around that if an admin is truly determined. Like, maybe they just disable in private mode,
mm-hmm.
you know, in which case you're kind of SOL at that point.
Yeah, or they could mirror the files.
Or they could mirror the files. But, you know, we highly doubt that anyone's really ever going to do that. And if you're worried about your admins, perhaps not use that machine for the sensitive
or do your banking on your phone,
or, you know, just do it on an asset that you're not worried about.
Yeah, wait till you get home to look at your medical information.
Right.
All right, so next question. I'm running out of room on a partition on my hard drive, and I want to merge it with another partition that they had blown away that had Windows 2008 server on it. The operation seems straightforward. I was using Paragon Partition Manager. The issue that I'm having is that in order to do this, the partition you want to extend or merge with must be first in the sequence. So the idea here is that you've got your C drive, and you want to merge it with D.
Right.
But D comes before C in this case.
Right.
So how would you do this?
How would I do this?
How would you do it?
If it was me, I would actually take a backup of the whole thing, blow it away, and install,
yeah,
and then restore from backup.
Yeah.
Because when you start messing around with partitions, even the best partition managers out there, something can go wrong
yeah.
during this operation. If you truly, truly don't want to do that, you don't want to backup and restore and start from scratch, the inbox Windows utility for extending partitions doesn't work where you're extending from the beginning of a partition
yeah.
into a previous one. There's just too many issues with it that we found that we didn't want to do that for users. There are third parties that you can go to that there are a bunch of free ones out there that will do this for you. Your mileage may vary. Again, before you do any partition manipulation, back up your data.
Of course.
And I figure if you're going through all the time to back up the data anyways, which is really
yeah.
the longest part of all yeah. of this, you can easily blow it away and start from scratch.
Yeah. So it is possible, but either, yeah, no matter what you do, back it up.
Back it up.
You're playing with partitions here. This is too important to not back up ahead of time.
Exactly.
All right, good one. So next question here. Whenever I try to open a new notepad to keep notes on my desktop, for a user who keeps a lot of notes on their desktop, it closes the current notepad and opens and replaces it with a new one. How can I open up multiple notepads at once? Hold shift, click on the notepad icon down in the taskbar. It'll open up as many new ones as you want. Doesn't close anything ahead of it, so there you have it. Easy. Next question. I recently bought a keyboard to get two additional USB ports. The problem that the person is having is that the USB ports on this keyboard aren't powerful enough to power the things they want to power, like a webcam and stuff like that. And they're asking, is there a way to up the 100 milliamp power going to this thing and make it a little bit more power?
My guess is that that keyboard was probably designed to, you know, have maybe another mouse plugged in or maybe a USB key plugged in.
Yeah.
You got potentially one of two problems or two problems. It's either the hardware, you know, there's just a hardware limitation, or it's the driver that was used that is not kicking up the output.
Yeah.
I have no idea which one of those that it is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get updated drivers and it works, great. Otherwise, buy a powered hub, plug it in. It's just really the best way to go anyways.
So they were just hoping they could plug their thing up to their keyboard. It's not getting enough power. I mean, we've probably seen this before. If you have a device that uses a lot of power and you stick it in some unpowered or some low power.
Well, I mean, every USB port should be outputting a 500 milliamp minimum.
Yeah.
Some of them will output an amp.
Yeah.
It all really depends on the piece of hardware. It's unfortunate that, you know, this particular keyboard only does 100 milliamp.
Yeah.
It's possible it's defective. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd phone or I'd call up the support folks for, was it a Logitech you said?
Yeah, Logitech.
And maybe, you know, it's just a defective keyboard and something else is wrong.
Okay, but in the long and short of it, though, is you can plug a powered hub up to it.
Yep.
The hub's going to power the devices, and it's going to plug into the keyboard, which is going to pass through the data, which is what's important. So it is possible, but you're going to end up with another cord, which is probably not what they are looking for.
Right.
All right. Next question. I'm using Windows 7. I'd like to have a feature like Little Snitch on the Mac that alerts you whenever a program on your computer makes an outgoing connection. Is there a program like Little Snitch for Windows?
Probably. You know, a lot of different third-party firewalls will alert you for outgoing connection attempts.
Yeah.
Zone Alarm is one of them. Generally, I found that they're not all that helpful. They're usually overly noisy.
Yeah.
I
haven't used Zone Alarm in many years, but
me
I remember
neither.
When I did, when you first install it, you're like, oh, that's trying to connect, and that's interesting. After, like, the third day, you're like, okay, I get it, really. My computer's trying to connect everything.
Exactly.
So it just is something that kind of wears on you. But if you want to do that, it's certainly an option.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
There are some advanced firewall rules that you can use, and I looked into that briefly. But basically, they are set up to either allow or deny.
Mm-hmm.
So if you set it to deny, then great, it'll get logged, and you go review logs. But there's no notify. Because, again, it's very noisy.
Yeah. Okay. Next question. I have an external hard drive incorrectly detected as internal. How to change and enable swap and eject? I was thinking about this last night when we read the question, and I also have a dock where I put 3.5-inch hard drives in it.
Mm-hmm.
I leave them in there all the time, so I didn't even think about it. But sometimes when I have to take those out,
mm-hmm.
I notice it. I mean, the drive's still spinning. It's like holding a gyroscope, and I'm very concerned about it. I'm very delicate when I pick it up, turn it slowly, and set it down safely. But there probably should be an eject. Is there a way to say this is an external hard drive and to safely
eject
it?
It all depends on what mechanism that they're using in order to connect up to the machine.
Yeah.
Like, I know on not this laptop, but my home laptop, I have an eSATA P connection. And when I hook up a drive to it, it shows up properly as external.
Yeah.
If they've, you know, run a cable from an internal SATA port out to a backplane, and then have another cable going to their drive directly to the machine, it's all internal. There's really not much you can do there.
Would it be dangerous to connect a drive to that anyway while the machine is on?
It's not recommended.
Yeah, right. Not to make sure it's backed up.
Right.
Okay. All right, and so am I like throwing dice every time I pull one of these?
Absolutely.
Drives out?
If it's a dock,
important drives too. So.
if it's a dock that I've got a similar dock, right?
Yeah.
There is a power button next to it.
There is, yeah.
So if you hit the power, like multi-step, eject the drive from Windows.
If you can, it'll
tell the system, hey, this drive is no longer being used. Then hit the power button on your dock.
Wait for him to spool down.
Wait for him to spin down, and then hit the eject button, and then you're good to go.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Okay. Next question. I've installed Windows 7 over Vista. The Windows 7 setup has moved the previous Vista installation to a folder Windows Old. Now I want to remove Windows 7 and go back to Vista. Can I do that?
My first question is, why would you want to?
Yeah.
Who in their right mind is going from Windows 7 back to Vista?
Yeah. More importantly, though, no.
No.
No, it's not going to happen.
No.
And even if you could do it, I wouldn't trust it.
That, right.
You've changed too much stuff. You should flatten and go back if that's what you want to do.
So, absolutely.
Yeah, don't do that. All right, so I'm running Windows 7. I'd like to use Remote Desktop to connect my home computer, and I want to enable password security for Remote Desktop, but I don't want to have to enter a password to log into my computer if I'm physically at my other computer. Is there a way to do this?
So, oddly enough.
Yeah, so they want to not have a password when they log in to their computer, but they want to have a password when they're remote admin. We talked about this before.
Yep, auto log on.
Yeah.
So you do have a password, and then locally, when you start up your machine, it just logs you in.
So just do a password.
Yep.
Watch our old show. We'll tell you how to make it so it's like there's no password when you start your computer.
Mm-hmm. And then when you remote desktop in, there is a password. You enter it. You log in, and you're done.
Best of both worlds. There you go. All right, so next question. The default in Windows 7 is blue and red for drives, depending on how much is on those. How do I change those colors? This was another question that we had from someone in the comments who asked, how do I get rid of red, because their ReadyBoost drive is always going to be full.
Right. It's kind of weird, I know. Unfortunately, these are stored in resources that comes with Windows, and it's not something that's user configurable.
Yeah. So there's no themes or anything like this for the colors on this.
Unfortunately, no. I mean,
standard teal and red.
Perhaps if you go into high contrast mode, then it'll pick a different theme part. Mm-hmm. But that's clearly not what you'd want to do if you're if you have a different theme. If you're more of a blackened theme, like mine is. I tend to go with much darker backgrounds and themes. But no, unfortunately. That can't be changed, but again, I rarely ever go through Explorer to look at my drives anyways.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of like the red anyway. I mean, it draws my eye and makes me know things might be going on there. But I could see how if you have a drive that's always going to be full, after a while, it's not really red to you. It's just a full drive.
Right.
Okay, but you can't do it, so there you have it. I swap out drives quite a lot and do searches for files on those drives. Is there a way to keep removed drives indexed and have it tell me when which unconnected drive has the file that I'm looking for?
I did a little bit of research into it, but I haven't actually tried it yet. But it appears if you can mark the drive or the folder, all the folders within that drive as available offline. See if I can... So library location.
You just do it off a directory on your.
Yeah, you can mark it as available offline and. You might have to actually enable offline files, which is in the control panel, which I don't have enabled right now.
Okay.
But, if you enable offline files, you mark a directory or a file as available offline, it will keep it in the index, and you should still be able to search for it.
Excellent. All right. So there you go. All right. Next question. Is there anything like a hotkey that will copy highlighted text and open the text editor with that text already in it?
Not in Windows. Make it.
Yeah, make it happen.
It's not all that complicated. You write a new application, you give it a hotkey sequence and a shortcut. As part of its, you can activate that hotkey sequence. When the app starts up, you programmatically get the clipboard contents, and then you can invoke whatever application that you want, paste the contents, and boom, you're done.
Yeah, so it's possible, but yeah.
That's how I'd write
not
it.
Not out of the box.
Excellent. You know, I could write a C# application in, you know, 10 minutes that would do this.
Yeah. All right, next question. Most information I see about migrating physical machines to VMs. I'm looking to do the opposite. I want to take a VM and a virtual PC and migrate it to a physical computer.
Mm-hmm. You can do it. The reason why it's, you know, not easily done is because it's rather complicated and it just isn't easily done.
Yeah.
What you can do is take a VM, sysprep it, take the VHD, and then boot from the VHD, and then it will prep it to your machine and then specialize against the hardware that you have in that machine. So it's technically possible to do. And that's how I would do it, is you run sysprep on the VM first.
Nice. Okay. So it is possible, though.
Yeah.
There you have it. All right. How would I go about installing Visual Studio 2010 and all of its dependencies entirely on a RAM disk? I have a 16 gig RAM in my computer and a 4 gig RAM disk just for Visual Studio. If I try to install Visual Studio using a normal installer, it still adds a ton of things to my default hard drive. I'd like all dependencies to be on the RAM disk, plus Visual Studio itself and any cache it might have, etc.
I've not tried this before, but I believe you could use something like reparse points to redirect the Visual Studio install to what it thinks is the program files directory.
Yeah.
But you've now redirected that folder to your RAM disk.
Yeah.
A couple of questions came to mind, though, is, you know, what do you do when your system turns off?
Yeah, because
you lose your install.
Yeah, it's kind of made for very temporary files.
Very temporary files, right. Like, I've got RAM disks set up for my particular build process where I know that temp files are just, you know, being written, mm-hmm. but not ever being persisted. You know, so I just throw them to a RAM disk, and if they go away, they go away. It makes no difference.
Yeah. So if you shut your machine down,
unless he's got some sort of battery backup, or, you know, during the shutdown he mirrors it to the disk again.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious as to, you know, how much speed he thinks that he's losing by not having VS on the RAM disk.
Yeah. So what would you suggest? I mean, what is the faster way to do it? Could you just use like an SSD or something?
An SSD would certainly help, yeah.
Okay, so that's getting you most of the way there.
Yep.
That's going to be faster anyway, so that's an idea. Okay, excellent. All right, next, pick of the week. Pick of the week. You got one you want to talk about, and I love this one too.
We both use this a lot.
Yeah.
Monoprice.com. Whenever we need to buy cables, you know, NIC cables, USB cables, whatever.
Yeah.
This is the place that we go to. Super high quality stuff for an amazingly cheap price. Like, first thing, HDMI cables. I mean, we're always picking up HDMI cables, right? And, you know, multicolored.
So wait a minute. Are you telling me that I don't need to buy the $80 HDMI cable?
The monster HDMI?
At the big box store? Not naming names.
No.
Thank you.
No. I would never, ever buy that.
Yeah.
I mean, even if these cables, you know, didn't last terribly long,
yeah,
you can just keep buying them over and over. And to date, I have never actually had any issues whatsoever with any piece of hardware that has come from Monoprice.
Well, that's it.
And I bought hundreds of cables.
Yeah, this studio is wired on Monoprice cables. I mean, we placed so many orders when we were redoing the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I mentioned in the show, in the comments for last week, is in the middle of the show, that monitor did go out, mm-hmm. and it was a bad cable that turned out. It's weird. The cable was twisted. The connector was kind of bent on it. You could tell. But, I mean, the thing is, it was a cheap cable, and there's like 10 more in the back, so I just end up replacing it with another one. And so, yeah, but, you know, one of the things I really like about Monoprice, too, is that they have mounts.
Yes.
And mounts are really expensive in a lot of places. And so when I was trying to mount my plasma to my wall, I was just sickened by how much it was going to cost. And then I come to Monoprice, I'm like, why? What happened here? Why are they so cheap? And I have no idea.
And what's really weird is that they're high quality. I mean, these are sturdy, sturdy mounts. Let's see.
So, yeah, $38.
You know, look at this. For $60, you can get a tilting, swiveling mount.
That holds up to a 60-inch screen.
60-inch screen, 175 pounds.
Yeah, that's not too shabby. And, not too bad.
And everybody's reviews are, like, super high. You know, I love this site because of the reviews.
Yeah.
You know, it's why I go to a lot of online places, because I actually get honest reviews as opposed to a salesperson that's trying to shove something on me.
Yeah, or whatever is, you know, cheap and on the front page or stuff like that. I want to hear what problems people have had. And
right, exactly. You know, so, like, you get to look at all of the specs of this, manuals, tells you all the parts that have come in it. You know that you're getting something brand new, you know, not a store return because it's missing parts. It tells you caveats.
For my plasma mount, too, I mean, I was looking on eBay, so I was going to end up with somebody's old hand-me-down.
Right.
But, you know, you can always just go to Monoprice. So, yeah, today's show brought to you by Monoprice. There you have it.
I recommend their network cables. Their Cat 6 cables are really, really good with jackets and stress relief.
Yeah. One of the things that I always buy for home on this is just USB extension cables. And I have a mountain of USB 3 extension cables. I can just plug them all together and, you know,
yep. It
makes life really easy when you just need something to be a lot longer.
Yeah, they have nice shielded cables, which I love. You know, they're heavy gauge cables. You know, you can run good 25 feet, 50 feet on them, and it's fine.
Yeah, we use a lot of FireWire cables here, too, for our cameras. And when they get long, you end up with some kind of, you know, some problems. So, and when we expanded the studio, the cameras got further away. So, yeah, you want good FireWire cables for that.
Yeah, if you didn't know about Monoprice, I highly recommend checking them out.
It's worth checking out.
And, you know, just explore, because they've got some stuff here, you know. They'll keep adding new stuff.
Yeah.
And, yeah, if you ever do a renovation or something and you need wall plates, you know, this is the place to go.
Very affordable.
Very, very affordable. And in quantity, you get additional discounts.
Prices, yeah. Excellent. All right, well, that's the show for this week. If you have questions, you can email us at defragshow@microsoft.com. You can leave notes in the comments, but we prefer an email so we can get back in touch with you. So see you next week.
Thanks.